From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, The SUV, we talk with journalist Keith Bradshaw, author of High and Mighty, about the sport utility vehicle. It's one of the auto industry's most profitable and popular cars. Bradshaw says despite its reputation for safety, the SUV is dangerous for those who drive it and those who share the road with it. Also, novelist Rohinton Mistry. His new book, Family Matters, is set in Bombay, where Mistry was born. His two previous novels, A Fine Balance and Such a Long Journey, were both shortlisted for the Booker Prize. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews In the Devil's Snare, A History of the Salem Witch Hunts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. Top officials of the FBI and CIA are defending their performance before the September 11th attacks. NPR's Steve Inskeep has more.
Congressional investigators have spent days laying out what they consider missed opportunities, missed clues, and a general failure to focus on the threat of al-Qaeda. The FBI's counterterrorism supervisor disputes those ideas. Dale Watson testified before a congressional committee.
Somehow or another, people think that we were asleep at the switch. We have dedicated men and women. We have individuals, field agents, support people, professional staff that have absolutely worked themselves almost to death over this problem.
And Watson suggested that if anybody made a mistake, Congress might have helped to make it. The counterterrorism chief says that in the 3 years before the attacks, he repeatedly asked for more agents. Lawmakers sharply cut back his requests. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, Washington.
The U.S. government apparently gave 48 classified documents to accused September 11th conspirator Zacharias Moussaoui by mistake. According to court records released today, the judge in the case called that mistake a grave security breach. The documents were FBI summaries of interviews. They were given to Moussaoui as part of the evidence turned over to him by government prosecutors. Moussaoui is not supposed to see any classified documents. A Justice Department official says the government is quite confident that he never read those documents. President Bush met with a group of Republicans and Democrats from the House today. He was pushing for quick passage of a congressional resolution authorizing action against Iraq. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The meeting lasted a half an hour, during which the president laid out what he sees as the urgency of getting a resolution out of both the Congress and the UN. A day after being accused by Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle of politicizing the issue of national security, the president today talked about bipartisanship.
We're making progress. We're near an agreement. And soon we will speak with one voice.
Democratic leaders Daschle and Richard Gephardt were not at the White House meeting, and both continue to express concern that the president is using the war on terrorism for political gain for himself and for Republican candidates in the midterm election now less than 6 weeks away. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
A federal judge today approved a $740 million deal between U.S. Airways and an Alabama pension fund. The deal gives the struggling airline emergency financing, and the pension fund will receive a stake in the airline once it emerges from bankruptcy. The deal is said to have come together over the past week after the proposal was initially met with skepticism. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 155 points, or 2%, to finish the day at 79.97. The Nasdaq closed down less than a point. The S&P 500 closed up 15 points. This is NPR News. Diplomats say a full-scale evacuation of Westerners from one of two rebel-held cities in the Ivory Coast is now underway. The latest violence in that country began after a failed coup attempt. Yesterday, French troops rescued dozens of American students who had been trapped at a mission school for 6 days. Two Islamist militants were killed in Gaza today in a missile attack from Israeli helicopters. At least 27 bystanders were injured. Palestinian officials say a third senior militant escaped with moderate injuries. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
The target of the Israeli strike was Mohammed Deif, the leader of the Hamas military wing, who has long been at the top of Israel's wanted list. Israel television originally reported Deif had been killed in the Israeli attack on a car in Gaza City. But the television later broadcast pictures of an injured man next to the burning car, who was apparently Mohammed Deif. Palestinian hospital officials said more than half of the injured bystanders were under age 18. In other violence, four Palestinians were killed, one of them a baby. Hospital officials said died from inhaling tear gas fired by Israeli troops in the market of the West Bank city of Hebron. An Israeli soldier was also killed in a clash with Palestinian gunmen. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Miguel Estrada is promising senators that he will not let his personal views get in the way of facts if he's confirmed to a position on the District of Columbia Court of Appeals. Estrada is hoping to become the first Hispanic on that court. The D.C. court is considered a stepping stone to the Supreme Court. He made his comments today before the Senate Judiciary Committee. I'm Dale Willman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Freddie Mac Foundation, working to strengthen families and help youth achieve their potential through funding of nonprofit organizations. FreddieMacFoundation.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. One out of every six cars sold in the U.S. is a sport utility vehicle. 20 million are currently on the roads. They have ample room for gear and family. They project an image of sporty adventurousness. And their size and heavy weight appear to offer extra protection in case of an accident. But my guest, Keith Bradshaw, argues in his new book, High and Mighty, that SUVs are not only deadlier to occupants of other vehicles, they also pose grave safety risks for their own drivers, with high rollover rates and poorly performing brakes. And their low gas mileage and high emissions rate make them one of the least environmentally friendly family cars on the market. Bradshaw was the Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times from 1996 through 2001. He's now the Times Hong Kong bureau chief. In his book, Bradshaw writes that despite the gas shortages and an emerging awareness of the environment, car manufacturers started seriously marketing SUVs in the 70s. You know, when you say the 1970s, I think that's the decade that the federal government imposed all sorts of regulations on the auto industry, safety and fuel economy and air pollution controls. And it was also, you know, the oil crisis and gas shortages. It seems so contradictory that SUVs sprung out of that decade.
It is, and it's because of an interesting coincidence. American Motors bought the Jeep brand at the end of 1969, and that was the first time that a company, American Motors, really tried to position utility vehicles as family vehicles. The chairman of American Motors then had the vision that these were, that many Americans would like the off-road image. He was no longer marketing the SUV to rural customers, people who wanted to be able to use it for hunting and fishing. He saw it as a vehicle that could be sold through American Motors dealerships in every big city in the country, and he did that very successfully. At the same time, really by coincidence, you had the rise of environmental and safety pressures on the auto industry, and American Motors was the least equipped of the then big four Detroit automakers to cope with these pressures. American Motors didn't have the engineering capability to design Jeeps to meet, for example, the air pollution requirements that were coming along. And so in 1973, the Environmental Protection Agency decided that it would classify Jeeps as, quote, non-passenger vehicles. They would not be subject to the air pollution rules that were becoming increasingly stringent for cars because American Motors couldn't meet those requirements. And rather than have American Motors be driven out of business, not able to sell Jeeps and forced to rely on its dwindling car sales, instead the EPA decided to classify the Jeeps effectively as trucks. From that decision, many other decisions have flowed. For example, 3 years later, the Department of Transportation decided that utility vehicles, basically Jeeps then, would be classified as trucks for fuel economy purposes, for how many miles to the gallon they got. And that remains the case to this day. Since sport utility vehicles are allowed to get fewer miles to the gallon, on average, for each manufacturer, they can be a lot bigger, they can be a lot boxier, they can be a lot heavier than cars can. And that is one of the reasons why SUVs have gotten so big. In addition, if you make an SUV, or for that matter, a pickup truck, large enough and heavy enough, it's exempt entirely from the fuel economy standards. Another outgrowth of that decision to classify SUVs as trucks is that they've qualified for more lenient safety rules and for more lenient tax treatment.
Could you break down for us the economics of this market then? What the auto companies saved in expenses by investing in SUVs rather than investing in light, making cars lighter and more fuel efficient and meeting all the other requirements that were placed on cars in the 70s?
Sport utility vehicles are very inexpensive to design because most of them are still built on the same pickup truck underbodies that the automakers have been spending money to develop for decades for use by small businesses, farmers, as well as just people who like to drive a pickup. So when it, as the SUV market boomed, automakers were able, at a very small investment, to design longer passenger compartments that they could bolt on top of pickup truck underbodies that they'd already designed. The savings can be enormous. Combined with the markups that that manufacturers have been able to charge for SUVs, because they've been in such demand and the supply has been somewhat limited, so that a full-size SUV doesn't cost much more to manufacture than a mid-sized or perhaps a full-sized car, and yet you're selling something that costs $20,000, $25,000 to build. You're selling for $40,000, $45,000.
What other forces were at play in the 80s that made made SUVs a smart marketing investment for the auto industry? And I'm thinking that that was a decade of cheap gas.
Cheap gasoline made a big difference. The fuel economy rules enacted in 1975 by Congress and implemented by regulations a year later got tougher and tougher and tougher all the way through 1985. It was getting very, very hard for automakers to build large cars. Now, since then, mind you, automakers have come up with ways to make very fuel-efficient large cars, but in the mid-80s, they didn't have that capability. And so as gasoline prices fell dramatically, Americans wanted big vehicles again. The automakers couldn't sell them a lot of large cars without breaking the fuel economy rules, so they began selling them a lot of large sport utility vehicles instead. Even though they burned a lot of gas, they still met the more lenient, lower standards for light trucks.
So which came first, the impetus from the consumer for a utility vehicle that expressed this adventurous side of their personality, or was this fantasy something that the auto industry created?
I think there was a little bit of each, but certainly there was very strong consumer demand. When Jeep introduced the Jeep Cherokee in late 1983, the sales exceeded its own expectations, and each year they kept building and building and building. The marketing at the same time was also very effective in promoting an image of SUVs as vehicles that were providing this adventurous image, and often that tapped into deeper needs or worries on the part of many customers. For example, in the New York a week or two ago, there was an ad by General Motors for the Hummer. They bought the Hummer brand about 2 years ago. There was an ad for the Hummer showing a large Hummer, and it said, "Teach cabbies some respect." And there was a fake New Yorker cartoon showing a grinning driver at the wheel of his Hummer, and there was a taxi driver on either side, and they were both looking up in terror at the Hummer. The idea that you're able to intimidate other motorists, that people aren't going to get in your way, is something that tends to appeal to the SUV buyer. As GM's head of initial vehicle planning puts it, minivan buyers are people who like to feel in control of a situation, being able to do things with their vehicles like helping the elderly or what have you. SUV buyers, according to General Motors, are people who like to feel in control of others, and so that's reflected then in the marketing and the advertising.
I'd like to take a moment and talk about minivans, because they are the alternative vehicle for people who have big families and who need larger vehicles. And minivans don't come under the SUV classification. What are the safety and fuel efficiency records for minivans in comparison to SUVs? Are they a desirable alternative?
Well, minivans in many ways are tall cars. They're built like tall cars. and they tend to be more fuel efficient. They provide a lot of room inside. They don't have the high floor that you get in an SUV. The floors in SUVs are high in order to accommodate the off-road travel, so you get more usable room in a minivan. In my book, I praise large cars, which also provide a lot of room, as well as minivans. If you look, for example, at the current Chrysler Concorde, which is a full-size car, it offers as much interior room as a 1978 Chrysler New Yorker luxury sedan. It's a roomy, comfortable vehicle. It gets close to double the gas mileage of that Chrysler New Yorker sedan. In fact, the current Chrysler Concorde gets roughly the gas mileage of a 1978 Dodge Omni subcompact. So the fact is, there's been tremendous progress made by Detroit in improving the fuel economy of cars. However, what are people buying these days? They're buying Dodge Durango medium-sized to large full sport utility vehicles, and the Dodge Durango gets exactly the same gas mileage as that 1978 Chrysler New Yorker sedan.
Can you put SUVs in some context for us in terms of what their economic importance has been to the auto industry in the past decade? Just how profitable are they for the industry?
SUVs are important not just to the auto industry, but to the entire American economy, which is why I suggest caution in how the problems of SUVs are addressed. SUVs are extremely profitable and have done wonders for Detroit. The profit margins range from $6,000, $8,000 often on a mid-sized model to as much as $12,000 or $15,000 a piece on a full-sized luxury SUV. By contrast, automakers make almost nothing on their cars, small profit margins on their minivans, and only slightly larger margins on their pickup trucks. By taking a $20,000 or $25,000 work pickup truck and adding a lot of chrome in a larger passenger compartment for an extra $1,000 or $2,000, you can turn a humble pickup truck into a $40,000 SUV. So the profit margins are big. That's made a difference because the auto industry remains one of the cornerstones of the American economy in a way that many people on the coasts don't appreciate. For example, GM and Ford are the only two companies that each still account for 1% or more of the American economy's output. Each of them still has more than seven times the sales of the Microsoft Corporation. Each of them is still bigger than the entire American airline industry. And these are immense enterprises that have been brought great prosperity by the boom in sport utility vehicles. That prosperity has then spread to the workers and to much of the upper Midwest. I mean, housing prices in the Detroit area, for example, rose three times as fast as the national average during the 1990s.
My guest is Keith Bradshaw. He was the Detroit bureau chief of the New York Times from 1996 through 2001. He's been with the Times since 1989. Bradshaw is currently the paper's Hong Kong bureau chief. He has a new book about the history of sport utility vehicles. It's called High and Mighty. Keith, we're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're back with New York Times reporter Keith Bradshaw. He was the Detroit bureau chief for the Times from 1996 to 2001. He has a new book about the history and safety record of SUVs. It's called High and Mighty. Let's talk about safety and SUVs. When did safety concerns start cropping up with these vehicles? What were the early red flags?
Well, there were concerns about rollovers, for example, all the way back to the 1970s. There has been improvement, certainly, in SUVs since then, but as rollovers remain a greater problem for SUVs than they do for cars. Three-fifths of the deaths in SUVs are caused by rollovers compared to one-fifth of the deaths in cars.
I think a lot of SUV drivers believe, though, that rollovers are only a problem if you're driving recklessly and fast, and it's not a problem for your average responsible driver. Are they misguided in that?
Driving in a safe, responsible manner is absolutely the best way to avoid getting in trouble in the first place. However, What a lot of people don't realize about SUVs and rollovers is that most of the rollovers do not happen because somebody is zigzagging down a paved road. They tend to occur, in more than 90% of the cases, in fact, when the vehicle is tripped. That is, it nicks a curb, for example, or it strikes a lower-riding vehicle, or the wheels on one side are in the dirt or gravel of a soft shoulder. Something that stops the wheels or slows them sharply on one side of the vehicle can cause a rollover. And even a good driver can sometimes make a mistake that will cause a vehicle to slide or turn into a curb. Now, a car can also roll over if it hits a curb. The only concern is that the higher the center of gravity relative to the width between the wheels of the vehicle, the more susceptible it is to rolling over when you do find the vehicle being tripped.
Over the years, have things changed in SUVs' construction to make them less prone to rollovers or more prone? I'm thinking there are more and more SUVs that are taller and bigger.
The larger, heavier SUVs seem to roll over less often. They have just a lot of weight to hold them down. In addition, the automakers have begun introducing electronic stability systems on some of the larger models that make it less likely that you're going to start sliding into a curb or start sliding onto that shoulder or start sliding into a guardrail in the first place. So there has definitely been improvements. But that said, at the same time, we're selling, or the United States auto industry is selling more and more SUVs. And so it's a constant race between the rising number of SUVs and the industry's efforts to make SUVs closer to cars in terms of stability and safety. Overall, the number of rollovers is rising.
I think people who drive SUVs think they're safer in them for a number of reasons. They think four-wheel drive is safer, and I'm thinking of those ads where the SUV is driving fast down the road and then it stops on a dime to avoid hitting an armadillo or a frog or some such thing. There's this idea that four-wheel drive somehow means better traction and better braking. Where does the research come down on that?
Traction and braking are often related. But the thing to remember about four-wheel drive just means that the engine is providing power to turn all four wheels instead of just the front wheels for a front-wheel drive car or the rear wheels for a rear-wheel drive car. Four-wheel drive does not help you stop. In fact, if anything, SUVs have longer stopping distances than cars. Four-wheel drive can even be dangerous to the extent that people feel like they can go faster without slipping and sliding, because it does help you accelerate. And then you can end up in a very dangerous situation if you don't realize that you have no more brakes than the cars that are slipping and sliding around you. The person in a car who goes out on a wet or slippery or icy or snowy morning and is sliding two or three times coming down the driveway and getting onto the street is probably going to drive carefully and know that they might have a problem with the brakes. The person in an SUV who doesn't slip and slide as they're trying to accelerate might not realize that the traction and braking ability is not very good until they actually need the brakes, and then they could have a problem. The owner's manuals warn about this problem that four-wheel drive doesn't improve braking ability. But even the auto industry's own executives acknowledge that the message may not be getting out to people that four-wheel drive does not help your ability to stop.
What about this idea that you're better protected, though, by a bigger, higher vehicle than you would be by a car in an accident, in the case of an accident? And that's, again, why a lot of people buy SUVs.
What's important to remember is that the death rate for SUV occupants is as high or slightly higher than it is for car occupants. The extra bulk of an SUV does provide some benefit in a collision with another vehicle. However, it increases the likelihood of death or injury for the other motorist by far more than it decreases your risk. What's more, half of all deaths in traffic accidents are single vehicle accidents. Everybody assumes, well, that can't happen to me. But it's anybody can make a mistake, and an SUV is a less forgiving vehicle in which to make a mistake.
You're right that the safety situation with SUVs is bad now, but that this is just beginning. What are some of the factors that you're alluding to that, might contribute to, making the problem deadlier?
SUVs are about 25% of the vehicles sold now. There are only 2 or 3% of the vehicles being scrapped right now. So the number of SUVs is going to become dramatically greater. Right now, there are about 10% of the vehicles registered in the United States, and we're probably going to see that double over the next 10 or 15 years. At the same time, the people who drive SUVs are beginning to change. The first drivers have tended to be middle-aged families who are the most cautious drivers. They still have excellent hearing and vision. They are still physically robust so they can survive the collisions themselves, and they tend to be very responsible people. They also tend not to be out driving at 3 a.m., which is when accidents are particularly likely to occur. The danger will come as more of the used SUVs fall into the hands of teenagers who can't afford better vehicles. And then separately also, as more SUVs at some point fall into the hands of drunk drivers. There have been studies finding that drunk drivers tend to drive the cheapest vehicles available, and there are very few extremely cheap used SUVs available. The demand has been so strong for new SUVs that that has, at least until recently, held up the prices for used SUVs, so that if you want a $1,000 clunker, you can't find it as an SUV. You can find it as a car.
Keith Bradshaw's new book is called High and Mighty. We'll continue our conversation about SUVs in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Audi and the all-new A4 Cabriolet, available October 2002. Open up your world. Information at AudiUSA.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, novelist Rohinton Mistry. His new book, Family Matters, is set in Bombay, his native city. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews In the Devil's Snare, a new history of the 17th century Salem witch hunts. And we continue our conversation with Keith Bradshaw about the SUV. His new book is High and Mighty.
We'll be right back.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's continue our interview about the SUV with journalist Keith Bradshaw. He was the Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times for 5 years until 2001. He's now Hong Kong bureau chief for the Times. His new book, High and Mighty, is a biography of the sport utility vehicle. Bradshaw argues that SUVs are among the most dangerous cars on the road today. I found it interesting that you write that SUV drivers die differently than other motorists in accidents. What do you mean by that?
Well, they're far more likely to die in a rollover as opposed to in a collision that takes place on the flat, as it were, that is, with each vehicle keeping all four wheels on the road. Whether it's a rollover on hitting another vehicle or whether it's a rollover because they're tripped by a curb or a guardrail or whatever it might be. The other risk that people need to be aware of in connection with rollovers is paralysis. Rollovers are something like 2% of traffic accidents. A quarter of all traffic deaths, there are more deaths than side impacts and rear impacts combined, and there's something like 3/4 of the paralysis cases in traffic accidents. Now, why would that be the case? It's because a rollover is particularly likely to put strains on the neck and spine that can result in paralysis.
This is really a cautionary tale. Why don't we know more of this? I feel like I keep up with car research. I'm interested in it, interested in safety on the roads. I don't know a lot of this. Has the press not covered these issues?
There has been some coverage, but there has been such an enthusiasm for SUVs and such massive advertising and such coverage of just the enthusiasm of the boom that it hasn't always been as visible. In addition, the way the automakers prepare the reviews of the quality of their vehicles by reporters tends to result often in an assessment that's not the same kind of assessment you'd make of a car. To explain, they take plane loads of journalists to places like, just south of the Grand Canyon when the Explorer came out. Land Rover's taken people up to Hudson Bay and even to Outer Mongolia. And the test drives that they offer emphasize a lot of off-road driving as well as driving on highways. It's not a very good or proportionate representation in terms of how much time you spend driving. It's not a good representation of the kind of real-world driving conditions that most motorists find. If the SUVs were tested under the same kind of conditions that cars are tested, which is usually driving around a big city or driving around a lot of tight turns in the mountains, then I think the SUVs would tend to get less favorable ratings.
Have you gone on any of these trips?
Sure. I went, for example, on the introduction of the new completely redesigned 2002 Ford Explorer in November of 2000. And it was, frankly, a fun trip. The New York Times was reimbursing Ford in my case, but we went out to Phoenix. We had the earlier model of Ford Explorer to drive up into the mountains, which were absolutely beautiful at that time of year. Past the saguaro cactus with upstretched arms. We listened to some presentations about how the new vehicle was better. We then were able to drive the Explorer and a bunch of other often very expensive SUVs through the woods, Mercedes and so forth, the kind of luxury SUVs that you wouldn't be driving normally on an arduous off-road course. But that was a big part of this assessment program, was how they could wallow through the bogs and so forth. Then Ford took us all to a beautiful resort that was, as I recall, $325 a night, even in the off-season in November. We each had our three- or four-room suites, and we had a fabulous dinner under the stars with chefs serving us venison and duck pâté and so forth. There was an astronomer there with a very large fixed telescope through which we could admire the moons of Jupiter. There were cowboy musicians singing songs for us. While we were all done wallowing through the mud and so forth in the Explorers and other vehicles, the Ford crews were driving the vehicles overnight down to Phoenix for the next crew of journalists to test in the morning. They stayed up all night in order to wash them and get them looking good as new, check out all their mechanical details so that they were ready for the next day's crew of journalists. We then drove down out of the mountains the next morning in the Mercury Mountaineer. So it was a lot of fun, but it was not necessarily representative of the way that most people are going to drive these vehicles.
Keith Bradshaw, thanks very much for talking with me today on Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me on.
Keith Bradshaw's new book is called High and Mighty. Bradshaw is the Hong Kong bureau chief for the New York Times. Coming up, we meet novelist Rohinton Mistry. This is Fresh Air. Rohinton Mistry is a Canadian novelist who was born in Bombay. He's the author of a book of short stories, Swimming Lessons, and a novel, A Fine Balance, about four people whose lives intersect in the Bombay tenements. The novel was nominated for the Booker Prize, was an Oprah Book Club selection, and a New York Times bestseller. Now Mistry has a new book, Family Matters, also set in Bombay. In a review of the book in The New Yorker, John Updike writes that Mistry harks back to the 19th century novelists, for whom every detail, every urban alley, every character, however lowly, added a vital piece to the full social picture, and for whom every incident illustrated the eventually crushing weight of the world. Family Matters tells the story of the Vakil family. Nariman Vakil is a widower suffering from Parkinson's who lives with his two stepchildren. After a fall leaves him bedridden, his stepchildren scheme to move him into the cramped apartment of his biological daughter, their half-sister Roxana, which she shares with her husband and two sons. Taking care of Nariman tests Roxana's family's sense of duty, honor, and love, and redefines what family means for them. We begin with a reading from Family Matters. Here Roxana's husband, Yezad, is reflecting on his experience of the long months caring for Nariman.
Yezad returned to his teacup, not sure if Nariman had heard him. Strange trip, this journey towards death. No way of knowing how much longer for the chief. A year, 2 years. But Roxana was right, helping your elders through it. That was the only way to learn about it. And the trick was to remember it when your own time came. Would he wondered. What folly made young people, even those in middle age, think that they were immortal?
Rohinton Mistry reading from his novel, Family Matters. Much of the novel is about family conflicts that arise in caring for an elderly relative. And Nariman has Parkinson's, and his children struggle with the responsibilities of his care, the physical, the bodily details of it. Do you have experience with this? Have you cared for your own parents or in-laws?
No, I haven't. In my own home, my mother's parents lived with us in Bombay. So I watched my grandparents, I watched my friends' grandparents. There's enough around to see and observe and learn from. Well, I should also say that having been brought up in India, you are in much closer contact with grandparents, with the old, the elderly, the sick, than you are in Western society, mainly because there are not as many options as we have here. Old age homes, nursing homes, are only accessible to the very rich. So for the ordinary person, it is almost certain that when his parents or grandparents get old, they will be cared for in the home. There's no escaping it.
Bombay, the city, is almost like a third plot line in the book. And you describe it. You reading the book, you get this sense of what it would be like to be on the street in the city. You can hear the sounds of the street, smell the market as characters walk through the streets. And that's certainly true of your other novel, A Fine Balance. I think I remember reading in that book about
all sorts of street scenes, how a cripple moves when navigating the streets, how to load a dead buffalo on a cart, about men who make their living. Is this right? By collecting hair?
By collecting hair clippings. They collect hair and sell it by weight to wig makers and so on.
From the barbers on the street?
Yeah, from barbers and from hair salons. But of course, one character then gets a little more adventurous and does not wait for the clippings to fall. He starts stealing people's hair, clipping them in crowded places. Anyway, that's another book.
No, you grew up in Bombay, but you haven't lived there for, what, over 20 years?
You
emigrated to Canada. In writing so much about the city you left, is that a way to keep it close to you, to treasure it?
It's more a case of the city keeping me close to it and not letting go. It still engages my imagination, and that's why I continue to write about it. And of course, I visit, and people visit from there, and so there's a constant keeping in touch with the city. That helps to keep it fresh. I rely a lot on memory, though, when I write, memory and imagination.
Growing up in Bombay in the late 50s, the 60s, what was your family's financial situation? Because you write about the tenements of Bombay, but I believe your family was middle class. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. But the thing is that life in Bombay is all on display. If you keep your eyes open, you'll see everything. As you take the train, as you take the bus, you'll pass by the windows of people's little flats and apartments in tenements. The streets are narrow, and you can literally look into them and observe how they live, how many people to a room, and how the beds and the bedding is arranged, and how they store their pots and pans. And when you ride the train from the suburbs, you'll see the slums, people living by the train tracks in cardboard shacks and tin shacks. So it's all on display, all on view. And all you have to do is, as I say, keep your eyes open and you'll see it all.
How did you come to emigrate to Canada?
Well, not so much Canada, but the idea of emigrating to the West was the sort of idea that one grew up with, at least in that generation. You constantly heard this when you were a child, that to make a success of yourself, for a better future, for better prospects, one had to leave. One had to go and study abroad and settle in the U.S. or England or Australia or Canada, because that's where you could really make something of yourself. And India didn't offer any opportunities. And that was the story. So you believed it and you grew up, and that's what you tried to do. And if you succeeded, you received the congratulations of all those around you, and they wished you the best in your life, and you found yourself in a foreign country.
So it wasn't a conscious choice, Canada over the U.S. or over
England? Well, when it came to selecting, yeah, it was a conscious choice at that point. But the original idea of leaving was sort of implanted early on. So when it came time to around 1974, 75, and by that time, England no longer seemed a very attractive place, because we'd been hearing about the race riots in the late 60s and so on. And with the U.S., we'd been hearing all about Vietnam and all of that. And at that time, when I was ready to go or to leave, Canada seemed the most inviting place.
Well, you worked at a bank for a very long time. What, a decade?
Hmm. Yes.
What was your position?
I started as a clerk in the accounting department. I had a degree from Bombay University in mathematics and economics. But of course, I wasn't using any of that mathematics in the accounting department. I was adding and subtracting, basically. And that's where I started. And then by the time I quit 10 years later, I had worked my way up to a supervisor of the customer service department in the credit card department of the bank.
How did you get from banking to writing?
Well, there we have to go back a little to when I started working at the bank. After the first year or so, I very quickly realized that I wasn't going to be happy doing that as a career till I hit 65. And I needed something to make the days more stimulating. My wife and I, both of us, thought about taking evening classes at the university. Still all very tentative, nothing with a career orientation, just to make life more interesting. And since we both enjoyed reading, I mean, I'd always enjoyed reading from the very beginning, the Enid Blyton books, right through to Chekhov and Dostoevsky in my teens and later. Since we'd never had a chance to study literature and philosophy, that's what I decided to take at evening classes at the University of Toronto. Somewhere there, about after 2 or 3 years of doing that and enjoying it quite a bit, enjoying the assignments that we had to write, the essays, and some of them quite demanding and taxing, I realized I enjoyed the writing process. And around that time, the books I was reading and rereading sometimes, Chekhov and Turgenev and a lot of American literature, which I'd read before and I was rereading now, Saul Bellow and Updike and Bernard Malamud, John Cheever. All of this made me start to think about how I enjoyed writing the assignments and how I might enjoy doing creative writing. But of course, that was too exalted a thought, and it was just wishful thinking, I thought. When I was in my third or fourth year of university, still evening classes, of course, because I was still working full-time at the bank, there was an announcement in a campus newspaper about a short story competition. So I did write my first short story for that competition, enjoyed the process immensely, sent it in, and it won first prize.
Was that the first short story you'd ever written?
Yeah, it was. Well, I thought a lucky fluke. But I did keep writing, and the following year, when the contest was announced again, I sent in another story, and it won first prize again. So now I had to take it more seriously, that two lucky flukes in a row. Perhaps there's more than that. And since I was enjoying the process so much, I continued to write. I got a grant from the Canada Council for the Arts, which allowed me to give up my banking job and write full-time, and I managed to complete a short story collection, and the rest, I think you know.
What did you enjoy, or what do you enjoy so much about the process?
I think first, a writer has to enjoy solitude. And I enjoy solitude. I enjoy being alone in a room, working with words and sentences, putting them together. The sheer craft of stringing one word after another, one sentence after another, is something one has to enjoy if one wants to write. And then I think I enjoy the dreaming that it allows me to do, which again I suppose is tied up with solitude. Solitude encourages dreaming. And the making of the book itself, the craft of it, yeah, I have to say I enjoy that.
By craft, you mean figuring out a plot line and breaking it down into scenes?
That too, creating characters, being the puppet master, being the god for each book. I mean, it's creation. It's within the covers of the book, of course. And it's what I also like about it is that one has to learn the art of writing over again each time. At least for me, that's how it works. Each time I start a new novel, I learn once again how to write. And by that, I think I mean writing that particular story.
Well, Rohinton Mistry, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk today.
It's been a pleasure.
Rohinton Mistry's book is Family Matters. Coming up, a new history of the Salem witch trials. This is Fresh Air. In January 1692, in Salem Village, Massachusetts, two young girls began to suffer from inexplicable fits. So began the Salem witch hunts, the subject of countless books, films, and plays. Historian Mary Beth Norton has written a new history of the crisis, which looks for answers in unexplored territory.
As a longtime reviewer, I've called plenty of books spellbinding. But it seems in bad taste to apply that fitting term to Mary Beth Norton's new book, In the Devil's Snare. After all, this is an account of people who were condemned to death because other people accused them of casting spells. So instead of spellbinding, I'll call Norton's chronicle dazzling, even suspenseful. In the Devil's Snare is a new history of the 17th century Salem witch hunts, that year and a half long frenzy of trial by gossip in and around Salem, Massachusetts, in which 144 people were formally charged with being witches. By the time the trials were over, 20 of the accused had been put to death. The Salem witch hunts have always been inherently fascinating, but In the Devil's Snare is gripping to read for a whole other reason. Through meticulous research, encompassing geological charts, land records, personal letters, public sermons, and of course, the surviving trial documents, Norton enacts the role of the historian as detective. Ultimately, she arrives at a plausible, fresh hypothesis that addresses the enduring mystery of why so many villagers in Salem in 1692 began to suffer from what were thought of as supernaturally induced fits, and why the traditionally skeptical judges who presided over the witchcraft trials were so eager to believe them. Norton is a renowned scholar of American women's colonial history, and she was initially attracted to the Salem case because so many of the major players were women, particularly very young women and women of the lower or servant classes. For a short but remarkable time then in Salem, girls ruled. But as Norton researched the backgrounds of the female accusers, and particularly the 38 men in the throng they named as being witches, she began to see a startling pattern emerge. To her own surprise, she tells us in her introduction, the book she eventually wrote on Salem turned out to be a dual narrative of war and witchcraft. Norton discovered that most of the chief so-called witches and their victims had connections to a recent two-decade-long frontier war in Maine that's all but unknown now. Called then the Second Indian War, and by historians these days King William's War, this armed conflict pitted the native Wabanaki Indians in league with the French against British settlers. The contemporary survivors' accounts, Norton quotes, of families of men, women, and children being enslaved, hacked to death, or roasted alive by the Wabanakis are all but too gruesome to stomach. But what's intriguing, Norton says, is that this imagery of enslavement, dismemberment, and burning explicitly surfaces in the testimonies of the female accusers, some of whom were refugees from the Maine frontier resettled in Salem. Satan, significantly, was described by most of the tormented as looking like a dark man, a 17th century term for an Indian. Additionally damning is the fact that some of the alleged male witches had been directly responsible for wartime blunders that had cost relatives of the accusers their lives. The prominent judges at the witchcraft trials, Norton reminds us, were the very men who led the colony both politically and militarily. They therefore had an investment in believing that their lack of success in combating the Indians could be explained without reference to their own failings. If God had providentially caused the wartime disasters, and he had also unleashed the devil on Massachusetts, then they bore no responsibility for the current state of affairs. Norton's revisionary thesis about Salem is that the witchcraft crisis has to be read in the context of a forgotten war and of its impact on the collective fearful and embattled mentality of the region. Norton is anything but a sensationalist. In fact, In the Devil's Snare owes much of its narrative power to her stark and substantive assemblage of facts. So I hesitate to praise her book by saying that it has some of the impact of Edgar Allan Poe's short story, The Purloined Letter. By the end of In the Devil's Snare, Norton, the master historian detective, has pointed to a glaring clue about the origins of the Salem witchcraft crisis. It was there, out in the open all along, in the diaries, letters, and official documents of the period. All Norton had to do to locate the missing link was to think like a Puritan.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed In the Devil's Snare by Mary Beth Norton. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Lauren Krenzel. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, publisher of And Justice There Is None, a Kincaid and James detective novel by Deborah Crombie, author of A Finer End. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain.
A 50th anniversary edition of Singing in the Rain is now out on DVD. On the next Fresh Air, co-director and choreographer Stanley Donen tells us about filming Gene Kelly's famous Dance in the Rain. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
The sun's in my heart, and I'm ready for love. Let the storm...
Whimsical Wednesday. We're...